You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's episode of Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
Claudia Antolini.
And me, Edward Gomez.
So last month we talked about Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, depending on how you want to pronounce it. This star, the brightest star in Orion, or at least what used to be the brightest star in Orion, dimming over the last few months. Some new observations have shown maybe a reason for why it's dimming, Edward.
But it seems to be changing shape, which is quite unusual, because you think of a star as being round or spherical. And this is, on the face of it, a little bit worrying, but it could give a clue as to what's actually happening with the star. If you were to imagine that the surface of a star has lots of pockets of, like almost like bubbling gas, of convection zones all over the surface, if you were to blur that, it would look like it had changed shape, even though it really hasn't changed shape. You have bright patches and dull patches on it. Which is really not good news for Betelgeuse. It looks like it's going through its final death throes. But don't worry, it's probably got 100,000 years left in it.
It's a long time to...
It's quite a long time, yeah.
There's another possibility, which is there's a cloud of dust between us and it. So it's chucked off a cloud of material which is absorbing some of the light, which is another possible explanation, I guess.
Yeah, it's a red giant star, and they are known for having dust formed around them. So cosmic dust is not like Earth dust. It's not made from dead skin cells, but it's made from carbon atoms mostly. And these form in quite strange environments. They can form around these type of stars, red giant stars, particularly in the winds of stars, where you've got charged particles of the different elements zooming away from a star, and they clump together and you form this dust. It can also be formed in supernova explosions as well. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that this is what's happening here.
Another thing about Betelgeuse is that it's going through this phase of red giant, and it's right now in what's called the asymptotic giant branch phase. So this is something that happens to very massive stars when they expand. So their envelope becomes very, very big, and they so drop in temperature. And this phase for stars is quite dramatic. There's a lot of changes that happen all the time. It's like huge star quakes happening on Betelgeuse all the time. So you have it growing and then collapsing again, and then growing again and collapsing again. But here we're talking about a huge mass of very, very hot gas with nuclear reactions still happening in the envelope. So it's really going through a nice little dance. And what for us is a very long time, 100,000 years, for a star is quite a short lifespan. So it's like Betelgeuse is not having a nice night. It's sort of tossing around in the bed saying, no, I'm too hot, no, I'm too cold. So this is what we are sort of seeing in the night sky, these very dramatic phases of cooling off and then warming up again.
We'll have to see if it calms down. It's writhing around in the bed to see if its temperature stabilizes again. And I guess astronomers are now going to be watching this like a hawk, right, to see if anything happens. There's generally most consensus is that, as you say, it's not going to go supernova tomorrow or any time really soon. But to be able to watch a star that's relatively close, 600 light years away or thereabouts, doing this is something that we've simply not had the chance to do before, and probably won't have a chance certainly not in our lifetimes, but in a long time. There's no other stars that are that close and at this stage, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And when it does explode, as we've said on this programme before, it will be quite spectacular. It will be clearly visible in the daytime, and during the night it will cast a shadow.
It will be astonishing. So I think, although everyone admits that it's not going to go supernova soon, everyone is secretly hoping that it will.
One of my colleagues in the US, when the news was announced, actually went outside to see if it had exploded.
The other important thing to remember about very, very massive stars is that they're not that common. Because when you look at how stars form, you tend to find a lot of smaller mass stars, similar to the Sun, or even smaller mass. And very massive stars also tend to live for a much, much shorter amount of time. So really, when the very big massive chunky stars out there. There's not very many of them, which also justifies the interest of Betelgeuse from the astronomy community, because there just aren't that many of them. Mm-hmm. And we have one that's just in our stellar neighborhood, so to speak, and is displaying some quite interesting behavior.
It's certainly exciting to be looking at. Moving from one star to multiple stars that might have planets around them. There's a project that has been going on for a long time now. It's something called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this is listening to signals from alien races. There's a group largely based in the States, but I think they're an international group called Breakthrough Listen Initiative, a group funded by, I guess, billionaires and entrepreneurs and so on from around the world to do all sorts of what some would say weird and wacky science stuff, like trying to send fleets of spacecraft to Alpha Centauri and stuff like that. But they are funding some of these projects to listen to alien races. One of the things they're trying now is to try and target specific planets, which is maybe an interesting thing to do. I guess we find out.
Well, the universe is big and it's hard to find the right directions in which to point your cosmic ears to listen. So this sort of makes sense. You know, they want to look at relatively nearby stars that we have observed now have some planets around them. So maybe that's the best areas to look for.
I think they're probably going along with the idea that the universe is either just got the human race or life on Earth, or it's full of life, and just about every star that could host life does host life. So hopefully they're optimistic in that respect, and they're just saying, well, these are the 20 closest. If we assume that almost all planets have life, then these are going to have life, and they've been watching the Earth for a while, and so we might as well look for signs of life at those. It does a little bit, though, sound... the pessimist in me, it does sound a little bit as though they're just trying to grab headlines for something that's really not been in the public mindset for quite a while.
It's a nice idea, looking for alien races that might be looking at us from their planets. The idea is they're looking at planets at the time at which, if there was an alien race on that planet, they would currently be seeing the Earth pass in front of our own sun from their point of view, and so they might be taking the opportunity to stare at the Earth, or maybe shout at us in radio waves, which is what they're looking at. But still a bit of a needle in a haystack.
And you have to do it for a long time too.
Yeah.
I mean, if these people looked at the Earth now, then the light's going to take, 20 years or something to get to them?
Ooh, so Edward, are you saying there's people on other planets?
So an interesting idea, but we'll see whether it brings any results. I think a lot of people behind SETI would argue that it's an experiment. While the chance of it working are very slim, it's a kind of the idea is you kick yourself for not doing it if it turns out to be true. Going towards the galactic centre, we've got some interesting gas movements in the centre of our galaxy, is the headline written in this story. So this is not at the centre of our galaxy, but near the centre of our galaxy. There's some clouds of gas and dust that are moving in a slightly peculiar way, and they imply, Claudia, that there's something interesting at their centre.
Well, this is another one of those things that we're starting to find more about now that we have more and more sophisticated instruments. And generally, when there's something interesting happening in a very massive area, people start to think, ooh, black holes, just because it's been the biggest headline grabber over the last few years in astronomy. We're starting finally to find lots of them and to see them in a lot of different ways. So now we're so excited about black holes, we start to look for them and everywhere. And we are usually pretty lucky in finding them because black holes are relatively common, like not wildly common, but still common enough that you are likely to find one in various areas, even though the masses of black holes that you can actually observe are still quite limited for issues of formation and of theoretical limits of what general relativity allows. So you don't just find, you know, any sort of black possible mass of black holes, but you tend just to find them in certain ranges. So you can look at what those ranges are and then what will the physical processes associated with those environments that they can fuel or not. So maybe in the same way that in quasars, black holes are thought to be accreting or not accreting, so the object goes more active or less active. Maybe in this case, something like that, there could be some feedback process that happens.
Mm. So the thing they found is this cloud of gas that's rotating and spinning in a way such that if you look at how fast it's spinning, this cloud of gas, it's moving very quickly relative to our galaxy. The speed at which it's moving implies that the stuff could be orbiting a black hole that is not tens of times the mass of our sun, which is the kind of black holes we might see with things like LIGO and Virgo and gravitational wave detectors, and not billions of or millions or billions of times the mass of our sun, that is the kind of thing we see in the centres of massive galaxies, but somewhere in the middle, about 10,000 times the mass of our sun. And this class of object, this intermediate mass black hole, is something that is allowed by the theories, but it's not clear how you form them.
Mm.
I think that's fair to say.
No, it's also the other hard thing is that in this case it doesn't seem to be associated with a kind of emission.
Mm.
Whereas for stellar black holes you can expect to see them with gravitational waves because you have quite a bunch and they are in a nice range of wavelengths that you can observe with the instruments that we have now. And supermassive black holes tend to have, on the other hand, accretion disks, or they have a lot of mass that is around them that so will send some light. This class of black holes is not really clear what sort of mechanism could be associated with it that we could actually measure and observe, whether they are gravitational in nature, because you don't get gravitational waves from a perfectly spherical system. You need some sort of asymmetry in time.
So that's when LIGO and Virgo, we see two black holes
orbiting
colliding,
around each other,
rather than just one on its own. Yeah.
Whereas here, if you just have the one, it's you might hope to see pulses, but they will have to respect certain conditions, and they might not fall in the detection range of LIGO and Virgo. And for supermassive black holes, instead, you can spot their optical counterpart in action and then try to estimate the mass. But with this one, if we still don't know what is physically happening around them, that could be trickier to spot. So this one was, we think it could be there thanks to dynamical methods, not because we've spotted a typical optical or electromagnetic emission or a gravitational wave signal. So that I think that's where the mystery lies and descending. Is it really there? And if it's there, how did it form? What is feeding it? Will it become active at some point? And how?
It's intermediate mass black holes have been something that there have been lots of hints for, including this being one of the latest ones. But they're something that, yeah, we've never seen directly. They're sort of a bit of an enigma in astronomical circles. We've also had, this year, we've seen the end of some missions. So we've seen the end of the Spitzer Space Telescope, one of NASA's great observatories. So it launched 15 years ago. So it launched in 2003. So that's more than 15 years ago, in fact. It spent the last decade and a half studying the universe and the galaxy, solar system and so on in infrared light. So that generally lets it see colder stuff. It's done it's made a huge contribution to our understanding of the universe in general, but there have been some specific things that have been nice and surprising from it, I guess.
I should also say that my boss used to be the Spitzer principal investigator or a primary science person for the Spitzer Space Telescope. She's now the director of Las Cumbres Observatory, Lisa Story Lombardi. And when talking to her, she said that the fantastic thing about Spitzer was that, like many beautifully designed space telescopes, is that they do surprising things. That's in the nature of scientific discovery. You have a science mission that you really sell the idea of your instrument on. And in the case of Spitzer, It was mostly on looking at how stars form, but it's looking at infrared light, so it's looking at things which are cold in the universe, not as cold as things that Herschel was looking at. So we're looking at things like cosmic dust. They're not hot like stars, so things that are relatively cool up to a temperature of the Earth, like 30 degrees C, 300 Kelvin temperatures. And it's looking at infrared light, so that's a light that we can't see with our eyes. So it's although there have been quite a few different spacecraft and space telescopes that could see that type of light, Spitzer had quite an unprecedented resolution, and that's where it really came into its own, and actually why it had such a long lifetime, and why it became so useful in looking at a wide variety of different things outside of its initial remit, particularly in the field of exoplanets, looking at our own solar system as well. One of the big discoveries was confirming seven planets around a single star that weren't like the typical exoplanets that people find, sort of hot Jupiters, very 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 big and massive planets, but seven planets that were more or less like the Earth.
So very small rocky planets.
Yeah. And also it found the biggest ring of Saturn. It was something like 170 times the diameter of Saturn, it encompassed one of the furthest out moons.
It was Phoebe, wasn't it?
Phoebe,
was it?
That's right. And astronomers think that the ring is actually tidally stripped material off the surface of Phoebe, and actually Spitzer was a perfect complement to the Herschel Space Observatory because they had different areas of the electromagnetic spectrum still within the infrared band that they could observe, so you could get a really complete picture if you managed to get pictures of distant galaxies or star formation regions in our own galaxy, and you could build up a picture of what was happening in terms of not only the very cold things that were at -200, but also things that were in the hot phase, so you could really find out what was going on with the gas and the dust and find out what processes were happening there.
The exoplanet thing, and studying exoplanets, that must have been a real boon, because this was launched in the early 2000s. Now, the first exoplanet around a sun-like star was found in 1995, and by 2003, I'm not actually sure how many were found, but a handful, a few dozen maybe, not very many.
Not very many until Kepler came along.
Yeah, so certainly compared with the 4,000 odd we know of now. So it was a really, really young field. So when Spitzer was launched, and particularly when it was being designed in the 1990s and earlier, exoplanets were not really a thing to go and look for. So
no.
The fact that they could turn this spacecraft into an exoplanet observatory to be able to study exoplanets, and not used to yet helping discover these seven planets around one star, but also doing things like look at the observations of some of the largest exoplanets and almost do a weather map of them, to look at the temperature of the planet as it rotated. That's something that wouldn't have been imagined when the spacecraft was launched.
Yeah, that's right. And looking at the atmosphere of exoplanets is something that just shows that astronomers are really crafty individuals, and they really see the potential of something outside of what the manual says that it should be able to do. And other things that Spitzer did was looking at near-Earth asteroids, and anything that couldn't be seen with a conventional telescope, but can be seen in infrared lights, things like near-Earth asteroids. They don't reflect an awful lot of light, so they're very difficult to see with optical light or visible light telescopes. But they absorb light from the sun, and so they re-radiate it, so they glow because they have a temperature, and that's what Spitzer can see.
Well, the big thing about any space mission, really, is that they are so incredibly expensive and so hard to build and get to space safely that ideally you really want to get out of them as much as you can, even things that you didn't initially plan for, exactly because they are so hard to come by. You know, it's not just, oh, you know what, I ran out of my sample, I'll just run to the shop and buy some more. It takes 20, 30 years to get your instrument to space. So once it is up there and you realize, oh, cool, we can actually do more science with this than we expected, it's going to be, yes, let's do it.
One of the nice things about Spitzer as well is that it joined up with other things like the Deep Impact mission, which is another NASA mission, that deliberately crashed a probe the size of a washing machine made out of copper into a comet, Tempel 1. And then Spitzer looked at what shot out of it, as well as a lot of other telescopes, and actually analysing the contents of the inside of the comet told us a lot about what comets are made of, but also this was a pristine, like a Ziploc bag full of contents that the early solar system was made of. So things. So we learned a lot about the formation of the solar system from that.
It really makes you think with these space missions, the future missions that have got planned. So things like James Webb Space Telescope that's due for launch next year at the moment. We'll see if that slips anymore. But the things it will do beyond its stated science goals, it could give us a huge amount of information as well. So that's the end of one mission. We've got the start of other missions. So Solar Orbiter is it's a European Space Agency mission with, I think it's got some involvement from NASA, but led by European Space Agency. It is, as the name suggests, going to orbit the Sun. So it launched in February. It's going to get really close to the Sun, closer than planet Mercury is to the Sun. So it has to deal with a huge temperature variations. It didn't have the easiest start to its mission, though. There was a bit of a potential hiccup that they managed to solve, I guess.
Yes, they were when the spacecraft was deployed out of the rocket, it's all packed up and has various windows that are covering the sensitive instruments as it emerges from the rocket shell. And it still has those windows closed so that if there's any dust or debris in the area around the Earth, then it doesn't contaminate or doesn't even damage any parts of the spacecraft, particularly the sensitive instruments. And the ground control noticed that a few of the pins holding one of the windows in place was getting very, very cold, and that could not only cause them to freeze, but cause them to weld. And if they had welded, then they'd be shut forever, and actually it would have just been a floating brick. So they did a very smart thing, which was rotate the satellite so it faced the Sun, which they were actually trying not to do because they didn't want to, because that's the side that's facing outward, so it's going through the dust. But they did that just to melt the pins a little bit, and it worked. So safely on its way now and rotated back into position with the sensitive instruments facing away from the Sun until it gets closer.
It's a hint as to quite how much data comes from these missions. So not only do you have all the instruments, the cameras, the spectrometers, the plasma measures, the radio instruments, all those kind of things. You've also got lots of temperature measures. It's often called housekeeping data on the spacecraft itself to monitor things. But the fact that they can measure the temperature of some pins that are holding a window shut. I mean,
yeah,
I'm not sure who thought to put a thermometer on that.
Yes. Well, I guess it's a mission critical part as well, because, and they probably learnt from other missions that if a weld happens, then that's it.
Yeah, but you also have all the telemetries and all the position, velocity data and everything else. The interesting thing to consider when you think about, in general, an inner solar system mission is that it intuitively it seems easier because like you're going closer, but actually when you are launching that away from the orbit of Earth, it takes quite a bit of energy generating that difference in velocity that you need to orbit the inner solar system rather than the outer orbits from Earth. It's actually quite a bit harder. So getting a probe to orbit around the Sun is not only an issue for temperature, clearly, but for the fact that you have reaching the inner part of the solar system might take less time, but it's harder from the point of view of celestial dynamics to do rather than going to Mars, for example. It's much, much more challenging from a dynamics point of view.
And in fact, it takes Solar Orbiter a couple of years to get to its target orbit. So it's going to, it must do a flyby. I forget exactly what it flies by, but it must fly by Venus or Earth to do a gravitational assist to probably slow it down so it's not going too fast, but then also to kick it into an orbit that goes over the top, or maybe under the bottom, but either over the pole of the sun rather than in the equator, because we've never actually seen the top of the sun, which sounds bizarre because it's just there. But from Earth, we can never see the top of the sun, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's exactly what Claudia says. It's very difficult the orbital dynamics are very difficult, and so when we've sent probes to the sun in the past, they've been in the plane.
Yeah. The only exception, I think, was Ulysses, which was in the 1990s, as I remember, and that flew out to get that into orbit. They flew it out to Jupiter and then slingshotted it to go in this massive orbit around the sun. It basically did one flyby, but then because that orbit takes it 10 years or something, it did one flyby of the sun and then was going back out towards Jupiter. And eventually, the spacecraft died, ran out of fuel or power or whatever. But that had no cameras on. It had scientific instruments, but no cameras. So it told us a little bit about the environment around the sun, but no pictures of the top of the sun. So these days, to send a spacecraft up without a camera on sounds... I guess you wouldn't do that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, their cameras are so cheap. Even space-qualified cameras, I'm sure, are not as expensive as some other instruments. Well,
I think that this will... going back to what we were saying about Betelgeuse earlier, this would really go to show that stars are extremely dramatic environments, because can you imagine, you have this huge ball of gas that is rotating and you're looking at the top of the rotational axis. So it's an area in which they mixing from the center to the surface is really, really also involving the fact of the rotation at the top. So I would imagine that the magnetic field will get really, really messy there. So it will be an extremely interesting area for clearly solar physicists to look at, but also for stellar physicists, because from the sun, we are essentially able to learn more about all the other stars. As stars like Betelgeuse become objects that we can resolve, all these studies about the sun, about things like heliosismology, solar winds, are going then to feedback all the information back into the stellar models as well.
And you're right, the pole of the sun is a very it's going to be very different to the rest of the sun, because that's where the rotation is, at the pole, or the axis of rotation, that could be different to the rest of it. It reminds me of the Juno mission that is currently orbiting Jupiter in a polar orbit around Jupiter. When that first saw the poles of Jupiter, instead of seeing the white and brownish colour belts that we're used to seeing, it suddenly saw blues, and it saw, much like Saturn has a hexagon structure at one pole, it saw clouds of, I think one pole has five storms in a little pentagon, and the other pole has eight storms in a pentagon. So whether Solar Orbiter will suddenly see weird and wonderful patterns around the pole of the sun, who knows?
I'm quite excited. Waiting for that.
So hopefully we'll get some pictures soon. It's certainly been sending back data. So after this hiccup, it's been sending back data, and we'll hopefully start to get some pictures in the not too distant future, maybe even before it reaches its final science orbit. So a very exciting mission to look out for. Okay, so that's spacecraft and satellites. Let's go with people launching into space, not going to the sun. Luckily, that's a bad idea generally. So we had the return of a few astronauts coming from the International Space Station. That in itself is a little bit routine, but one of the astronauts, Christina Koch, has set a record. Claudia.
Yes, Christina Koch is now the woman holding the longest time on the International Space Station, 328 days. She also participated in the first all-woman spacewalk in 2019. So she's been quite a record breaker. She was also featured in a very moving video, her coming back home and her dog welcoming her back. It was very heartwarming. So it's not only the fact that we are able to send people to space for a very long time and then thankfully they come back unscathed, it's also studying the permanence of humans in space for very extended amounts of time will give us information on what are the effects of life in space on human beings. So we're looking at things like radiation, microgravity, all the adjustments our body has to do to that. So when you're back from space, you can't walk anymore because your inner ear is completely messed up because you were using to float so nicely. And now you're not floating anymore. You have one preferential direction, which is gravity. While you were up there in microgravity, you are constantly falling. Hence, for your own reference frame, it's like you had no gravity overall effect on your body. Coming back to Earth, this is no longer true, so astronauts have to go through physiotherapy in order to be okay and be adapted to Earth again. Your heart works in a slightly different way. If you stay in space for a very long time, or even for a short amount of time, really, you have to exercise a few hours a day in order not to lose your muscular mass, because again, you're not working against gravity anymore, which is what our muscles are used to. So in order to create enough strain that your body doesn't go completely relaxed, you have to keep exercising, because when you think about, even just sitting on a chair, your muscles are working against gravity. We just don't perceive it because we're used to it.
Even just the balancing to stay upright, right? Even your main abdomen, the muscle core in the abdomen is making sure you don't tip over and so on. That is very different if there's no gravity to tip
in
you
space,
over.
In space, there's not true anymore. So studying all these effects is important, not just because we're nosy and we want to know what happens to us, but because if we really are keen on sending people back to the moon for longer missions or even to Mars, even just the trip to Mars is going to take a few months.
Yeah.
So we have to know what we're in for. We have to make sure that, again, the safety of the people that we send is paramount. So knowing the effects that life in space has on people, space medicine, and also space psychology, because these are things that could alter the way that our brain works. We have to consider all of that. So after the twin study, now also Christina Koch is going to be observed by scientists, and she's going to be tested on certain responses to different tests and exercises that scientists have designed appropriately for her, because there's not that many people that have been to space for such a long time in a row. Luca Parmitano is another astronaut that has just come back, and he's been twice to the space station, but his flights were slightly shorter overall.
Yeah, and we had, as you mentioned, the twin study that was Scott Kelly, yes. And so he's a twin, and so they studied him versus his
They've
his
both
twin.
Been to space.
They've both been to space, but Scott spent a year there.
Yes, and Scott spent a year into space, and Mark has spent a bit less time in space. And from that study, I remember one of the most interesting results was that their DNA had actually been affected, which clearly for twins is more striking.
Yeah.
So epigenetics is affected by the space environment. Then DNA tends to repair itself a little bit, but essentially the longer time that Scott has spent in space with respect to Mark has meant that his DNA was slightly altered.
Interesting. So, yeah.
That's how you create a superhero.
I've seen that movie, yeah. So lots of things to try and figure out for the prospects for, as you say, missions to the moon, missions to Mars, and that sort. We've also had a new batch of a new class of astronauts been announced by NASA. So their next set of astronauts that are going to train to go up to the space station in, you know, these newfound private companies launching their spacecraft and so on. Dragon.
Possibly one of them or more might be going to the moon with Artemis. We don't know that.
Who knows if that happens?
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So, exciting times for that batch of astronauts as well. And I'm sure there'll be the European Space Agency will have a new set of astronauts, or always has new sets of astronauts training as well. So looking forward to
And then immediately after, NASA announced that they want to open up applications again for the new class of astronauts. So there's a big buzz right now in the
So if you want to go to space, now's the time to get into those.
Start training, people. Get on that treadmill.
Yeah, you have to be fit, I suppose.
Quite.
I suppose.
Clearly, none of us is trying this round.
So while none of us prepare to go into space, that's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find previous episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.